Our fence. At this moment, and for no apparent reason, Bernard suddenly remembered that he had left the eau de cologne tap in his bathroom wide open and running.
Supplied with current from the Grand Canyon Hydroelectric Station.
Cost me a fortune by the time I get back. With his mind's eye, Bernard saw the needle on the scent meter creeping round and round, ant-like, indefatigably. Quickly telephoned to Helmholtz Watson.
Upwards of 5,000 kilometers of fencing at 60,000 volts.
You don't say so, said Lenina politely, not knowing in the least what the warden had said, but taking her cue from his dramatic pause. When the warden started booming, she had inconspicuously swallowed half a gram of soma, with the result that she could now sit serenely not listening, thinking of nothing at all but with her large blue eyes fixed on the warden's face in an expression of rapt attention.
"To touch the fence is instant death," pronounced the warden solemnly. "There is no escape from a savage reservation."
The word escape was suggestive.
"Perhaps," said Bernard, half rising, "we ought to think of going."
The little black needle was scurrying, an insect nibbling through time, eating into his money.
"No escape," repeated the warden, waving him back into his chair, and, as the permit was not yet countersigned, Bernard had no choice but to obey. "Those who are born in the reservation... And remember, my dear young lady," he added, leering obscenely at Lenina and speaking in an improper whisper, "remember that in the reservation children still are born, yes, actually born, revolting as that may seem."
He hoped that this reference to a shameful subject would make Lenina blush, but she only smiled with simulated intelligence and said,
"You don't say so."
Disappointed, the warden began again.
"Those, I repeat, who are born in the reservation are destined to die there."
Destined to die. A deciliter of eau de cologne every minute. 6 liters an hour.
Perhaps, Bernard tried again, we ought.
Leaning forward, the director tapped the table with his forefinger.
"You ask me how many people live in the reservation, and I reply," triumphantly, "I reply that we do not know. We can only guess."
"You don't say."
"My dear young lady, I do say so."
6 times 24. No, it would be nearer 6 times 36. Bernard was pale and trembling with impatience, but... inexorably, the booming continued.
"About 60,000 Indians and half-breeds, absolute savages. Our inspectors occasionally visit. Otherwise, no communication whatever with the civilized world. Still preserve their repulsive habits and customs. Marriage, if you know what that is, my dear young lady. Families, no conditioning, monstrous superstitions. Christianity and totemism and ancestor worship, extinct languages such as Zuni and Spanish and Athapascan, pumers, porcupines, and other ferocious animals, infectious diseases, priests, venomous lizards."
"You don't say so."
They got away at last. Bernard dashed to the telephone. "Quick, quick." But it took him nearly 3 minutes to get on to Helmholtz Watson.
"We might be among the savages already," he complained. "Damned incompetence."
"Have a gram," suggested Lenina. He refused, preferring his anger. And at last, thank Ford, he was through. And yes, it was Helmholtz. Helmholtz, to whom he explained what had happened, and who promised to go round at once, and turn off the tap. Yes, at once. But took this opportunity to tell him what the DHC had said in public yesterday evening.
"What? He's looking out for someone to take my place?"
Bernard's voice was agonized.
"So it's actually decided? Did he mention Iceland? You say he did? Ford, Iceland!"
He hung up the receiver and turned back to Lenina. His face was pale, his expression utterly dejected.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"The matter?" He dropped heavily into a chair. "I'm going to be sent to Iceland." Often in the past he had wondered what it would be like to be subjected, somerless and with nothing but his own inward resources to rely on, to some great trial, some pain, some persecution. He had even longed for affliction. As recently as a week ago, in the director's office, he had imagined himself courageously resisting, stoically accepting suffering without a word. The director's threats had actually elated him, made him feel larger than life. But that, as he now realized, was because he had not taken the threats quite seriously. He had not believed that, when it came to the point, the DHC would ever do anything. Now that it looked as though the threats were really to be fulfilled, Bernard was appalled. Of that imagined stoicism, that theoretical courage, not a trace was left. He raged against himself. What a fool! Against the director. How unfair not to give him that other chance which, he now had no doubt at all, he had always intended to take. And Iceland. Iceland? Lenina shook her head. "Was and will make me ill," she quoted. "I take a gram and only am." In the end, she persuaded him to swallow 4 tablets of soma. 5 minutes later, roots and fruits were abolished. The flower of the present rosily blossomed. A message from the porter announced that, at the warden's orders, a reservation guard had come round with a plane and was waiting on the roof of the hotel. They went up at once. An octoroon in gamma-green uniform saluted and proceeded to recite the morning's program. A bird's-eye view of 10 or 12 of the principal pueblos, then a landing for lunch in the valley of Malpas. The rest house was comfortable there, and up at the pueblo, the savages would probably be celebrating their summer festival. It would be the best place to spend the night. They took their seats in the plane and set off. 10 minutes later, they were crossing the frontier that separated civilization from savagery. Uphill and down, across the deserts of salt or sand, through forests, into the violet depth of canyons, over crag and peak and tabletop mesa, the fence marched on and on, irresistibly the straight line, the geometrical symbol of triumphant human purpose. And at its foot, here and there, a mosaic of white bones, a still unrotted carcass stuck on the tawny ground, marked the place where deer or steer, puma or porcupine or coyote, or the greedy turkey buzzards drawn down by the whiff of carrion and fulminated as though by a poetic justice, had come too close to the destroying wires. "They never learn," said the green-uniformed pilot, pointing down at the skeletons on the ground below them. "And they never will learn," he added, and laughed, as though he had somehow scored a personal triumph over the electrocuted animals. Bernard also laughed. After 2 grams of soma, the joke seemed for some reason good, laughed, and then, almost immediately, dropped off to sleep, and sleeping was carried over Taos and Tisuki, over Nambe and Picoris and Pohaki, over Sia and Kochiti, over Laguna and Akuma, and the Enchanted Mesa, over Zuni and Cibola and Ojo Caliente, and woke at last to find the machine standing on the ground, Lenina carrying the suitcases into a small square house, and the gamma-green octoroon talking incomprehensibly with a young Indian.
"Malpas," explained the pilot, as Bernard stepped out. "This is the rest house, and there's a dance this afternoon at the pueblo. He'll take you there." He pointed to the sullen young savage. "Funny, I expect," he grinned. "Everything they do is funny." And with that he climbed into the plane and started up the engines. "Back tomorrow. And remember," he added reassuringly to Lenina, "they're perfectly tame. Savages won't do you any harm. They've got enough experience of gas bombs to know they mustn't play any tricks. Still laughing, he threw the helicopter screws into gear, accelerated, and was gone. Chapter 7 The Mesa was like a ship becalmed in a strait of lion-colored dust. A channel wound between precipitous banks, and slanting from one wall to the other across the valley, ran a streak of green, the river and its fields. On the prow of that stone ship in the center of the strait, and seemingly a part of it, a shaped and geometrical outcrop of the naked rock, stood the pueblo of Malpais. Block above block, each story smaller than the one below, the tall houses rose like stepped and amputated pyramids into the blue sky. At their feet lay a straggle of low buildings, a crisscross of walls, and on three sides the precipices fell sheer into the plain. A few columns of smoke mounted perpendicularly into the windless air and were lost. "Queer," said Lenina. "Very queer." It was an ordinary word of condemnation. "I don't like it, and I don't like that man." She pointed to the Indian guide, who had been appointed to take them up to the pueblo. Her feeling was evidently reciprocated. The very back of the man, as he walked along before them, was hostile, sullenly contemptuous. "Besides," she lowered her voice, "he smells." Bernard did not attempt to deny it. They walked on. Suddenly, it was as though the whole air had come alive and were pulsing, pulsing with the indefatigable movement of blood. Up there, in Malpais, the drums were being beaten. Their feet fell in with the rhythm of that mysterious heart. They quickened their pace. Their path led them to the foot of the precipice. The sides of the great Mesa ship towered over them 300 feet to the gunwale. "I wish we could have brought the plane," said Lenina, looking up resentfully at the blank impending rock face. "I hate walking, and you feel so small when you're on the ground at the bottom of a hill." They walked along for some way in the shadow of the mesa, rounded a projection, and there, in a water-worn ravine, was the way up the companion ladder. They climbed. It was a very steep path that zigzagged from side to side of the gully. Sometimes the pulsing of the drums was all but inaudible. At others, they seemed to be beating only just round the corner. When they were halfway up, an eagle flew past so close to them that the wind of his wings blew chill on their faces. In a crevice of the rock lay a pile of bones. It was all oppressively queer, and the Indians smelt stronger and stronger. They emerged at last from the ravine into the full sunlight. The top of the mesa was a flat deck of stone. "Like the Charing Ti Tower," was Lenina's comment. But she was not allowed to enjoy her discovery of this reassuring resemblance for long. A padding of soft feet made them turn round. Naked from throat to navel, their dark brown bodies painted with white lines, "like asphalt tennis courts," Lenina was later to explain. Their faces inhuman with daubings of scarlet, black, and ochre, two Indians came running along the path. Their black hair was braided with fox fur and red flannel. Cloaks of turkey feathers fluttered from their shoulders. Huge feather diadems exploded gaudily around their heads. With every step they took came the clink and rattle of their silver bracelets, their heavy necklaces of bone and turquoise beads. They came on without a word, running quietly in their deerskin moccasins. One of them was holding a feather brush. The other carried, in either hand, what looked at a distance like 3 or 4 pieces of thick rope. One of the ropes writhed uneasily, and suddenly Lenina saw that they were snakes. The men came nearer and nearer. Their dark eyes looked at her, but without giving any sign of recognition, any smallest sign that they had seen her or were aware of her existence. The writhing snake hung limp again with the rest. The men passed. "I don't like it," said Lenina. "I don't like it." She liked even less what awaited her at the entrance to the pueblo, where their guide had left them while he went inside for instructions. The dirt, to start with, the piles of rubbish that
dust, the dogs, the flies. Her face wrinkled up into a grimace of disgust. She held her handkerchief to her nose. "But how can they live like this?" she broke out in a voice of indignant incredulity. "It wasn't possible." Bernard shrugged his shoulders philosophically. "Anyhow," he said, "they've been doing it for at least 5,000 or 6,000 years, so I suppose they must be used to it by now." "But cleanliness is next to fraudliness," she insisted. "Yes, and civilization is sterilization," Bernard went on, concluding on a tone of irony the second hypnopedic lesson in elementary hygiene. "But these people have never heard of our Ford, and they aren't civilized, so there's no point in..." "Oh!" she gripped his arm. "Look!" An almost naked Indian was very slowly climbing down the ladder from the first-floor terrace of a neighboring house, rung after rung, with the tremulous caution of extreme old age. His face was profoundly wrinkled and black, like a mask of obsidian. The toothless mouth had fallen in. At the corners of the lips, and on each side of the chin, a few long bristles gleamed almost white against the dark skin. The long, unbraided hair hung down in grey wisps round his face. His body was bent and emaciated to the bone, almost fleshless. Very slowly he came down, pausing at each rung before he ventured another step. "What's the matter with him?" whispered Lenina. Her eyes were wide with horror and amazement. "He's old, that's all," Bernard answered as carelessly as he could. He too was startled, but he made an effort to seem unmoved. "Old?" she repeated. "But the director's old. Lots of people are old. They're not like that." "That's because we don't allow them to be like that. We preserve them from diseases. We keep their internal secretions artificially balanced at a youthful equilibrium. We don't permit their magnesium-calcium ratio to fall below what it was at 30. We give them transfusions of young blood. We keep their metabolism permanently stimulated. So of course they don't look like that. Partly," he added, "because most of them die long before they reach this old creature's age. Youth almost unimpaired till 60, and then, crack, the end." But Lenina was not listening. She was watching the old man. Slowly, slowly, he came down. His feet touched the ground. He turned. In their deep sunken orbits, his eyes were still extraordinarily bright. They looked at her for a long moment, expressionlessly, without surprise, as though she had not been there at all. Then slowly, with bent back, the old man hobbled past them and was gone. "But it's terrible," Lenina whispered. "It's awful. We ought not have come here." She felt in her pocket for her soma, only to discover that by some unprecedented oversight she had left the bottle down at the rest house. Bernard's pockets were also empty. Lenina was left to face the horrors of Malpace unaided. They came crowding in on her, thick and fast. The spectacle of two young women giving the breast to their babies made her blush and turn away her face. She had never seen anything so indecent in her life. And what made it worse was that, instead of tactfully ignoring it, Bernard proceeded to make open comments on this revoltingly viviparous scene. Ashamed, now that the effects of the soma had worn off, of the weakness he had displayed that morning in the hotel, he went out of his way to show himself strong and unorthodox. "What a wonderfully intimate relationship," he said, deliberately outrageous, "and what an intensity of feeling it must generate. I often think one must have missed something in not having had a mother. And perhaps you've missed something in not being a mother, Lenina. Imagine yourself sitting there with a little baby of your own. Bernard, how can you?" The passage of an old woman with ophthalmia and a disease of the skin distracted her from her indignation. "Let's go away," she begged. "I don't like it." But at this moment their guide came back, and, beckoning them to follow, led the way down the narrow street between the houses. They rounded a corner. A dead dog was lying on a rubbish heap. A woman with a goiter was looking for lice in the hair of a small girl. Their guide halted at the foot of a ladder, raised his hand perpendicularly, then darted it horizontally forward. They did what he mutely commanded.
climbed the ladder, and walked through the doorway, to which it gave access into a long, narrow room, rather dark and smelling of smoke and cooked grease and long-worn, long-unwashed clothes. At the further end of the room was another doorway, through which came a shaft of sunlight and the noise, very loud and close, of the drums. They stepped across the threshold and found themselves on a wide terrace. Below them, shut in by the tall houses, was the village square, crowded with Indians. Bright blankets and feathers in black hair and the glint of turquoise and dark skin shining with heat. Lenina put her handkerchief to her nose again. In the open space at the center of the square were two circular platforms of masonry and trampled clay, the roofs, it was evident, of underground chambers, for in the center of each platform was an open hatchway, with a ladder emerging from the lower darkness. A sound of subterranean flute playing came up, and was almost lost in the steady, remorseless persistence of the drums. Lenina liked the drums. Shutting her eyes, she abandoned herself to their soft, repeated thunder, allowed it to invade her consciousness more and more completely, till at last there was nothing left in the world but that one deep pulse of sound. It reminded her reassuringly of the synthetic noises made at solidarity services and Fourth Day celebrations. "Orgy porgy," she whispered to herself. The drums beat out just the same rhythms. There was a sudden startling burst of singing, hundreds of male voices crying out fiercely in a harsh metallic unison. A few long notes and silence, the thunderous silence of the drums. Then shrill, in a neighing treble, the women's answer. Then again the drums, and once more the men's deep, savage affirmation of their manhood. Queer, yes, the place was queer. So was the music, so were the clothes and the goiters and the skin diseases and the old people. But the performance itself, there seemed to be nothing specially queer about that. "It reminds me of a lower caste community sing," she told Bernard. But a little later, it was reminding her a good deal less of that innocuous function. For suddenly there had swarmed up from those round chambers underground a ghastly troop of monsters. Hideously masked or painted out of all semblance of humanity, they had tramped out a strange limping dance round the square, round and again round, singing as they went round and round, each time a little faster, and the drums had changed and quickened their rhythm, so that it became like the pulsing of fever in the ears, and the crowd had begun to sing with the dancers, louder and louder, and first one woman had shrieked, and then another, and another, as though they were being killed, and then suddenly the leader of the dancers broke out of the line, ran to a big wooden chest, which was standing at one end of the square, raised the lid, and pulled out a pair of black snakes. A great yell went up from the crowd, and all the other dancers ran towards him with outstretched hands. He tossed the snakes to the first comers, then dipped back into the chest for more, more and more, black snakes and brown and mottled. He flung them out, and then the dance began. And again on a different rhythm, round and round they went with their snakes, snakily, with a soft undulating movement at the knees and hips, round and round. Then the leader gave a signal, and one after another all the snakes were flung down in the middle of the square. An old man came up from underground and sprinkled them with cornmeal, and from the other hatchway came a woman and sprinkled them with water from a black jar. Then the old man lifted his hand, and startlingly, terrifyingly, there was absolute silence. The drums stopped beating. Life seemed to have come to an end. The old man pointed towards the two hatchways that gave entrance to the lower world, and slowly, raised by invisible hands from below, there emerged from the one a painted image of an eagle, from the other that of a man, naked and nailed to a cross. They hung there, seemingly self-sustained, as though watching. The old man clapped his hands. Naked, but for a white cotton breechcloth, a boy of about 18 stepped out of the crowd and stood before him, his hands crossed over his chest, his head bowed. The old man made the sign of the cross over him and turned away. Slowly, the boy began to walk round the writhing heap of snakes. He had completed the first circuit and was halfway through the second when, from among the dancers, a tall man wearing the mask of a coyote and holding in his hand a whip of plaited leather advanced towards him. The boy moved on as though unaware of the other's existence. The coyote man raised his whip. There was a long moment of expectancy. Then a swift movement, the whistle of the lash, and its loud, flat-sounding impact on the flesh. The boy's body quivered, but he made no sound. He walked on at the same slow, steady pace. The coyote struck again, again, and at every blow at first a gasp, and then a deep groan went up from the crowd. The boy walked on. Twice, thrice, four times round he went. The blood was streaming. Five times round, six times round. Suddenly, Lenina covered her face with her hands and began to sob. "Oh, stop them! Stop them!" she implored. But the whip fell, and fell inexorably. Seven times round. Then, all at once, the boy staggered, and, still without a sound, pitched forward onto his face. Bending over him, the old man touched his back with a long white feather, held it up for a moment crimson for the people to see, then shook it thrice over the snakes. A few drops fell, and suddenly the drums broke out again into a panic of hurrying notes. There was a great shout. The dancers rushed forward, picked up the snakes, and ran out of the square. Men, women, children, all the crowd ran after them. A minute later, the square was empty. Only the boy remained, prone where he had fallen, quite still. Three old women came out of one of the houses, and with some difficulty lifted him and carried him in. The eagle and the man on the cross kept guard for a little while over the empty pueblo. Then, as though they had seen enough, sank slowly down through their hatchways, out of sight, into the nether world. Lenina was still sobbing. "Too awful," she kept repeating, and all Bernard's consolations were in vain. "Too awful, that blood," she shuddered. "Oh, I wish I had my soma." There was the sound of feet in the inner room. Lenina did not move, but sat with her face in her hands, unseeing, apart. Only Bernard turned round. The dress of the young man who now stepped out onto the terrace was Indian. But his plaited hair was straw-coloured, his eyes a pale blue, and his skin a white skin, bronzed.
"Hallo. Good morrow," said the stranger, in faultless but peculiar English. "You're civilized, aren't you? You come from the other place, outside the reservation."
"Who on earth?"
Bernard began in astonishment. The young man sighed and shook his head.
"A most unhappy gentleman."
And pointing to the bloodstains in the centre of the square,
"Do you see that damned spot?"
he asked in a voice that trembled with emotion.
"A gram is better than a dam," said Lenina mechanically from behind her hands. "I wish I had my soma."
"I ought to have been there," the young man went on. "Why wouldn't they let me be the sacrifice? I'd have gone round 10 times. 12, 15. Palotiwa only got as far as 7. They could have had twice as much blood from me. The multitudinous seas incarnadine."
He flung out his arms in a lavish gesture, then despairingly let them fall again.
"But they wouldn't let me. They disliked me for my complexion. It's always been like that, always."
Tears stood in the young man's eyes. He was ashamed and turned away. Astonishment made Lenina forget the deprivation of soma. She uncovered her face and, for the first time, looked at the stranger.
"Do you mean to say that you wanted to be hit with that whip?"
Still averted from her, the young man made a sign of affirmation.
"For the sake of the pueblo, to make the rain come and the corn grow, and to please Pukong and Jesus, and then to show that I can bear pain without crying out. Yes,
and his voice suddenly took on a new resonance. He turned with a proud squaring of the shoulders, a proud, defiant lifting of the chin, to show that I'm a man.
Oh!
He gave a gasp, and was silent, gaping. He had seen, for the first time in his life, the face of a girl whose cheeks were not the colour of chocolate or dogskin, whose hair was auburn and permanently waved, and whose expression, amazing novelty, was one of benevolent interest. Lenina was smiling at him. Such a nice-looking boy, she was thinking, and a really beautiful body. The blood rushed up into the young man's face. He dropped his eyes, raised them again for a moment, only to find her still smiling at him, and was so much overcome that he had to turn away and pretend to be looking very hard at something on the other side of the square. Bernard's questions made a diversion. Who? How? When? From where? Keeping his eyes fixed on Bernard's face, for so passionately did he long to see Lenina smiling that he simply dared not look at her. The young man tried to explain himself. Linda and he... Linda was his mother. The word made Lenina look uncomfortable. Were strangers in the reservation. Linda had come from the other place long ago, before he was born, with a man who was his father. Bernard pricked up his ears. She had gone walking alone in those mountains over there to the north, had fallen down a steep place, and hurt her head.
"Go on, go on," said Bernard excitedly.
Some hunters from Malpais had found her and brought her to the pueblo. As for the man who was his father, Linda had never seen him again. His name was Tomakin. Yes, Thomas was the DHC's first name. He must have flown away back to the other place, away without her, a bad, unkind, unnatural man. "And so I was born in Malpais," he concluded. "In Malpais." And he shook his head. The squalor of that little house on the outskirts of the pueblo. A space of dust and rubbish separated it from the village. Two famine-stricken dogs were nosing obscenely in the garbage at its door. Inside, when they entered, the twilight stank and was loud with flies.
"Linda!"
the young man called. From the inner room, a rather hoarse female voice said,
"Coming!"
They waited. In bowls on the floor were the remains of a meal, perhaps of several meals. The door opened. A very stout blonde squaw stepped across the threshold and stood looking at the strangers, staring incredulously, her mouth open. Lenina noticed with disgust that two of the front teeth were missing, and the colour of the ones that remained. She shuddered. It was worse than the old man, so fat, and all the lines in her face, the flabbiness, the wrinkles, and the sagging cheeks with those purplish blotches, and the red veins on her nose, the bloodshot eyes, and that neck, and the blanket she wore over her head, ragged and filthy, and under the brown sack-shaped tunic, those enormous breasts, the bulge of the stomach, the hips, oh, much worse than the old man, much worse. And suddenly the creature burst out into a torrent of speech, rushed at her with outstretched arms, and fought. It was too revolting. In another moment she'd be sick, pressed her against the bulge, the bosom, and began to kiss her. Fought to kiss, slobberingly, and smelt too horrible, obviously never had a bath, and simply reeked of that beastly stuff that was put into Delta and Epsilon bottles. No, it wasn't true about Bernard. Positively stank of alcohol. She broke away as quickly as she could. A blubbered and distorted face confronted her. The creature was crying.
"Oh, my dear, my dear!"
The torrent of words flowed sobbingly.
"If you knew how glad, after all these years, a civilized face, yes, and civilized clothes, because I thought I should never see a piece of real acetate silk again."
She fingered the sleeve of Lenina's shirt. The nails were black.
"And those adorable viscous velveteen shorts. Do you know, dear, I still got my old clothes, the ones I came in, put away in a box. I'll show you them afterwards. Though, of course, the acetate's all gone into holes. But such a lovely white bandolier. Though I must say your green morocco is even lovelier. Not that it did me much good, that bandolier.
Her tears began to flow again.
I suppose John told you what I had to suffer, and not a gram of soma to be had. Only a drink of mezcal every now and then when Pepe used to bring it. Pepe is a boy I used to know. But it makes you feel so bad afterwards, the mezcal does, and you're sick with the peyotl. Besides, it always makes that awful feeling of being ashamed so much worse the next day. And I was so ashamed. Just think of it, me, a beta, having a baby. Put yourself in my place.
The mere suggestion made Lennon a shudder.
Though it wasn't my fault, I swear, because I still don't know how it happened, seeing that I did all the Malthusian drill, you know, by numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, always. I swear it. But all the same, it happened. And, of course, there wasn't anything like an abortion centre here. Is it still down in Chelsea, by the way?
She asked. Lennon nodded.
And still floodlighted on Tuesdays and Fridays?
Lennon nodded again.
That lovely pink glass tower.
Poor Linda lifted her face and with closed eyes ecstatically contemplated the bright remembered image.
And the river at night, she whispered.
Great tears oozed slowly out from between her tight-shut eyelids.
And flying back in the evening from Stoke Poges. And then a hot bath and a vibro vacuum massage. But there...
She drew a deep breath, shook her head, opened her eyes again, sniffed once or twice, then blew her nose on her fingers and wiped them on the skirt of her tunic.
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
she said in response to Lennon's involuntary grimace of disgust.
"I oughtn't have done that, I'm sorry. But what are you to do when there aren't any handkerchiefs? I remember how it used to upset me, all that dirt and nothing being aseptic. I had an awful cut in my hip when they first brought me here. You can't imagine what they used to put on it. Filth, just filth. Civilization is sterilization, I used to say to them. And streptococ G to Bambury T to see a fine bathroom on WC, as though they were children. But of course they didn't understand, how should they? And in the end I suppose I got used to it. And anyhow, how can you keep things clean when there isn't hot water laid on? And look at these clothes. This beastly wool isn't like acetate. It lasts and lasts, and you're supposed to mend it if it gets torn. But I'm a baiter. I worked in the fertilizing room. Nobody ever taught me to do anything like that. It wasn't my business. Besides, it never used to be right to mend clothes. Throw them away when they got holes in them and buy new. The more stitches, the less riches. Isn't that right? Mending's so antisocial. But it's all different here. It's like living with lunatics. Everything they do is mad.
She looked round, saw John and Bernard had left them, and were walking up and down in the dust and garbage outside the house. But nonetheless confidentially lowering her voice and leaning while Lenina stiffened and shrank so close that the blown reek of embryo poison stirred the hair on her cheek.
"For instance," she hoarsely whispered, "take the way they have one another here. Mad, I tell you, absolutely mad. Everybody belongs to everyone else, don't they? Don't they?"
she insisted, tugging at Lenina's sleeve. Lenina nodded her averted head, let out the breath she had been holding, and managed to draw in another one, relatively untainted.
"Well, here," the other went on, "nobody's supposed to belong to more than one person, and if you have people in the ordinary way, they others think you're wicked and antisocial. They hate and despise you. Once a lot of women came and made a scene because their men came to see me. Well, why not? And then they rushed at me. No, it was too awful. I can't tell you about it."
Linda covered her face with her hands and shuddered.
"They're so hateful, the women here. Mad, mad and cruel. And of course they don't know anything about Malthusian drill or bottles or decanting or anything of that sort. So they're having children all the time, like dogs. It's too revolting. And to think that I... Oh, Ford, Ford, Ford! And yet John was a great comfort to me. I don't know what I should have done without him. Even though he did get so upset whenever a man... Quite as a tiny boy, even. Once, but that was when he was bigger, he tried to kill poor Waihusiwa. Or was it Pope? Just because I used to have them sometimes. Because I never could make him understand that that was what civilized people ought to do. Being mad's infectious, I believe. Anyhow, John seems to have caught it from the Indians, because, of course, he was with them a lot, even though they always were so beastly to him and wouldn't let him do all the things the other boys did. Which was a good thing in a way, because it made it easier for me to condition him a little. Though you've no idea how difficult that is. There's so much one doesn't know. It wasn't my business to know. I mean, when a child asks you how a helicopter works or who made the world, well, what are you to answer if you're a beta and have always worked in the fertilizing room? What are you to answer?
Chapter 8. Outside, in the dust and among the garbage, there were four dogs now, Bernard and John were walking slowly up and down.
"So hard for me to realize," Bernard was saying, "to reconstruct, as though we were living on different planets, in different centuries. A mother and all this dirt and gods and old age and disease," he shook his head, "it's almost inconceivable. I shall never understand unless you explain."
"Explain what?"
"This,"
he indicated the pueblo.
"That,"
and it was the little house outside the village.
"Everything, all your life."
"But what is there to say?"
"From the beginning, as far back as you can remember."
"As far back as I can remember?"
John frowned. There was a long silence. It was very hot. They had eaten a lot of tortillas and sweet corn. Linda said,
"Come and lie down, baby."
They lay down together in the big bed.
"Sing."
And Linda sang. Sang,
"Streptococci to Banbury tea."
And,
"Boy, baby, banting, soon you'll need decanting."
Her voice got fainter and fainter. There was a loud noise, and he woke with a start. A man was standing by the bed, enormous, frightening. He was saying something to Linda, and Linda was laughing. She had pulled the blanket up to her chin, but the man pulled it down again. His hair was like two black ropes, and round his arm was a lovely silver bracelet with blue stones in it. He liked the bracelet, but all the same, he was frightened. He hid his face against Linda's body. Linda put her hand on him, and he felt safer. In those other words he did not understand so well, she said to the man,
"Not with John here."
The man looked at him, then again at Linda, and said a few words in a soft voice. Linda said,
"No."
But the man bent over the bed towards him, and his face was huge, terrible. The black ropes of hair touched the blanket.
"No,"
Linda said again, and he felt her hand squeezing him more tightly.
"No, no."
But the man took hold of one of his arms, and it hurt. He screamed. The man put up his other hand and lifted him up. Linda was still holding him, still saying, "No, no!" The man said something short and angry, and suddenly her hands were gone.
"Linda! Linda!"
He kicked and wriggled. But the man carried him across to the door, opened it, put him down on the floor in the middle of the other room, and went away, shutting the door behind him. He got up. He ran to the door. Standing on tiptoe, he could just reach the big wooden latch. He lifted it and pushed. But the door wouldn't open.
"Linda!"
he shouted. She didn't answer. He remembered a huge room, rather dark, and there were big wooden things with strings fastened to them, and lots of women standing round them making blankets, Linda said. Linda told him to sit in the corner with the other children while she went and helped the women. He played with the little boys for a long time.
Suddenly, people started talking very loud, and there were the women pushing Linda away, and Linda was crying. She went to the door, and he ran after her. He asked her why they were angry.
"Because I broke something," she said.
And then she got angry too.
"How should I know how to do their beastly weaving?" she said. "Beastly savages!"
He asked her what savages were. When they got back to their house, Poppet was waiting at the door, and he came in with them. He had a big gourd full of stuff that looked like water, only it wasn't water but something with a bad smell that burnt your mouth and made you cough. Linda drank some, and Poppet drank some, and then Linda laughed a lot and talked very loud, and then she and Poppet went into the other room. When Poppet went away, he went into the room. Linda was in bed and so fast asleep that he couldn't wake her. Poppet used to come often. He said the stuff in the gourd was called mescal. But Linda said it ought to be called soma, only it made you feel ill afterwards. He hated Poppet. He hated them all the men who came to see Linda. One afternoon, when he had been playing with the other children, it was cold, he remembered, and there was snow on the mountains, he came back to the house and heard angry voices in the bedroom. They were women's voices, and they said words he didn't understand, but he knew they were dreadful words. Then, suddenly, crash, something was upset. He heard people moving about quickly, and there was another crash, and then a noise like hitting a mule, only not so bony. Then Linda screamed, "Oh, don't, she said. He ran in. There were three women in dark blankets. Linda was on the bed. One of the women was holding her wrists. Another was lying across her legs so that she couldn't kick. The third was hitting her with a whip, once, twice, three times, and each time Linda screamed. Crying, he tugged at the fringe of the woman's blanket. "Please, please!" With her free hand, she held him away. The whip came down again, and again Linda screamed. He caught hold of the woman's enormous brown hand between his own and bit it with all his might. She cried out, wrenched her hand free, and gave him such a push that he fell down. While he was lying on the ground, she hit him three times with the whip. It hurt more than anything he had ever felt, like fire. The whip whistled again, fell, but this time it was Linda who screamed.
"But why did they want to hurt you, Linda?" he asked that night.
He was crying because the red marks of the whip on his back still hurt so terribly. But he was also crying because people were so beastly and unfair, and because he was only a little boy and couldn't do anything against them. Linda was crying too. She was grown up, but she wasn't big enough to fight against three of them. It wasn't fair for her either.
"Why did they want to hurt you, Linda?"
"I don't know. How should I know?"
It was difficult to hear what she said because she was lying on her stomach and her face was in the pillow.
"They say those men are their men," she went on.
And she did not seem to be talking to him at all. She seemed to be talking with someone inside herself. A long talk which she didn't understand. And in the end, she started crying louder than ever.
"Oh, don't cry, Linda. Don't cry."
He pressed himself against her. He put his arm round her neck. Linda cried out,
"Oh, be careful, my shoulder. Oh!"
And she pushed him away hard. His head banged against the wall.
"Little idiot!"
she shouted. And then suddenly she began to slap him. Slap, slap.
"Linda!" he cried out. "Oh, mother, don't!"
"I'm not your mother. I won't be your mother."
"But Linda, oh!"
she slapped him on the cheek.
"Turned into a savage," she shouted. "Having young ones like an animal. If it hadn't been for you, I might have gone to the inspector. I might have got away. But not with a baby. That would have been too shameful."
He saw that she was going to hit him again, and lifted his arm to guard his face.
"Oh, don't, Linda, please don't."
"Little beast!"
She pulled down his arm. His face was uncovered.
"Don't, Linda!"
He shut his eyes, expecting the blow. But she didn't hit him. After a little time, he opened his eyes again, and saw that she was looking at him. He tried to smile at her. Suddenly, she put her arms round him, and kissed him again and again.
Sometimes, for several days, Linda didn't get up at all. She lay in bed and was sad, or else she drank the stuff that Pope brought and laughed a great deal and went to sleep. Sometimes she was sick. Often she forgot to wash him, and there was nothing to eat except cold tortillas. He remembered the first time she found those little animals in his hair, how she screamed and screamed. The happiest times were when she told him about the other place.
"And you really can go flying whenever you like?"
"Whenever you like."
And she would tell him about the lovely music that came out of a box, and all the nice games you could play, and the delicious things to eat and drink, and the light that came when you pressed a little thing in the wall, and the pictures that you could hear and feel and smell, as well as see, and another box for making nice smells, and the pink and green and blue and silver houses as high as mountains, and everybody happy, and no one ever sad or angry, and everyone belonging to everyone else, and the boxes where you could see and hear what was happening at the other side of the world, and babies in lovely clean bottles. Everything so clean, and no nasty smells, no dirt at all, and people never lonely, but living together and being so jolly and happy, like the summer dances here in Malpais, but much happier, and the happiness being there every day, every day. He listened by the hour, and sometimes when he and the other children were tired with too much playing, one of the old men of the Pueblo would talk to them, in those other words, of the great transformer of the world, and of the long fight between right hand and left hand, between wet and dry, of a Wanawilona who made a great fog by thinking in the night, and then made the whole world out of the fog, of Earth Mother and Sky Father, of Ahayuta and Masai Lima, the twins of war and chance, of Jesus and Pukong, of Mary and Etzanatalihi, the woman who makes herself young again, of the black stone at Laguna, and the great eagle and Our Lady of Acoma. Strange stories, all the more wonderful to him for being told in the other words, and so not fully understood. Lying in bed, he would think of heaven, and London, and Our Lady of Acoma, and rows of babies in clean bottles, and Jesus flying up, and Linda flying up, and the great director of World Hatcheries, and a Wanawilona. Lots of men came to see Linda. The boys began to point their fingers at him. In the strange other words, they said that Linda was bad. They called her names he did not understand, but that he knew were bad names. One day they sang a song about her, again and again. He threw stones at them. They threw back. A sharp stone cut his cheek. The blood wouldn't stop. He was covered with blood. Linda taught him to read. With a piece of charcoal, she drew pictures on the wall. An animal sitting down, a baby inside a bottle. Then she wrote letters. The cat is on the mat. The tot is in the pot. He learned quickly and easily. When he knew how to read all the words she wrote on the wall, Linda opened her big wooden box and pulled out from under those funny little red trousers she never wore a thin little book. He had often seen it before.
"When you're bigger," she had said, "you can read it."
Well, now he was big enough. He was proud.
"I'm afraid you won't find it very exciting," she said, "but it's the only thing I have," she sighed. "Oh, if only you could see the lovely reading machines we used to have in London."
He began reading. "The Chemical and Bacteriological Conditioning of the Embryo. Practical Instructions for Beta Embryo Store Workers." It took him a quarter of an hour to read the title alone. He threw the book on the floor.
"Beastly, beastly book," he said, and began to cry.
The boys still sang their horrible songs about Linda. Sometimes, too, they laughed at him for being so ragged. When he tore his clothes, Linda did not know how to mend them.
In the other place, she told him, people threw away their clothes with holes in them and got new ones.
"Rags! Rags!" the boys used to shout at him.
"But I can read," he said to himself, "and they can't. They don't even know what reading is." It was fairly easy, if he thought hard enough about the reading, to pretend that he didn't mind when they made fun of him. He asked Linda to give him the book again. The more the boys pointed and sang, the harder he read. Soon he could read all the words quite well, even the longest. But what did they mean? He asked Linda, but even when she could answer, it didn't seem to make it very clear. And generally, she couldn't answer at all.
"What are chemicals?" he would ask.
"Oh, stuff like magnesium salts and alcohol for keeping the deltas and epsilons small and backward, and calcium carbonate for bones and all that sort of thing."
"But how do you make chemicals, Linda? Where do they come from?"
"Well, I don't know. You get them out of bottles, and when the bottles are empty, you send up to the chemical store for more. It's the chemical store people who make them, I suppose. Or else they send to the factory for them. I don't know. I never did any chemistry. My job was always with the embryos."
It was the same with everything else he asked about. Linda never seemed to know. The old men of the pueblo had much more definite answers. "The seed of men and all creatures, the seed of the sun and the seed of earth and the seed of the sky, Awanawilona made them all out of the fog of increase. Now the world has four wombs, and he laid the seeds in the lowest of the four wombs.
And gradually the seeds began to grow."
One day, John calculated later that it must have been soon after his 12th birthday, he came home and found a book that he had never seen before lying on the floor in the bedroom. It was a thick book and looked very old. The binding had been eaten by mice. Some of its pages were loose and crumpled. He picked it up, looked at the title page. The book was called The Complete Works of William Shakespeare. Linda was lying on the bed, sipping that horrible stinking mescal out of a cup.
"Pope brought it," she said.
Her voice was thick and hoarse, like somebody else's voice.
"It was lying in one of the chests of the Antelope Kiver. It's supposed to have been there for hundreds of years. I expect it's true, because I looked at it and it seemed to be full of nonsense. Uncivilized. Still, it'll be good enough for you to practice your reading on."
She took a last sip, set the cup down on the floor beside the bed, turned over on her side, hiccuped once or twice, and went to sleep. He opened the book at random. "Nay, but to live in the rank sweat of an enseamed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty." The strange words rolled through his mind, rumbled like talking thunder, like the drums at the summer dances, if the drums could have spoken. Like the men singing the corn song, beautiful, beautiful, so that you cried. Like old Mitsima saying magic over his feathers and his carved sticks and his bits of bone and stone. Kiatla tsilu siloque 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 kiai silu silu tsitl. But better than Mitsima's magic, because it meant more, because it talked to him. Talked wonderfully and only half understandably a terrible, beautiful magic about Linda. About Linda lying there snoring with the empty cup on the floor beside the bed. About Linda and Popeye. Linda and Popeye. He hated Popeye more and more. A man can smile and smile and be a villain. Remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain. What did the words exactly mean? He only half knew, but their magic was strong and went on rumbling in his head, and somehow it was as though he had never really hated Poppet before, never really hated him because he had never been able to say how much he hated him. But now he had these words like drums and singing and magic, these words and the strange, strange story out of which